From Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Joyce Vance.
How you doing, Joyce?
Doing good, Preet. How are you doing?
We're deep into 2022.
Well, is the second week of January deep?
Well, it feels like a very long year.
2022 has been the longest year ever.
By the way, we have one quick announcement for our listeners that we have a new Cafe Insider referral program. So now you can invite your friends and family to join you in staying informed and listening to our conversations and all the interesting things that Joyce has to say. For every person that you bring to the Cafe Insider community, you'll get a month free added to your membership. To find out more, go to cafe.com/referral. That's a good plan.
It really is. I mean, you know, make all of your friends smart. I love reading, by the way, the notes that we get from everybody. Barb and Asha and Melissa's notes and Ellie's notes are great. And you're pretty good too, Preet.
Speaking of notes, you had a very widely appreciated note last week in 2022, which always have sparkling legal analysis, interesting conclusions, observations, talk about your experience and your expertise. And in this particular note, one of the legal issues that you address is how to make a perfect chocolate chip cookie.
This is a critically important legal issue that all former prosecutors are familiar with. Now, I'm the beneficiary of a really good secret about baking from a family member, which is anything that has chocolate should also have some Kahlua in it. It will make it better. And that's true for my chocolate chip cookie recipe. So I was glad to get a chance to share it.
The former Attorney General of the United States himself, one Eric Holder, weighed in on Twitter. I think he called your chocolate chip cookies the bomb.
He did. And it sort of made me both happy and sad for old times. You know, Holder loves chocolate chip cookies. And he actually came to Birmingham for my swearing in, which you will remember because you and I were confirmed very early. So this was early in the administration. And he came down not because he wanted to see me get sworn in, but because I promised to make chocolate chip cookies.
You made chocolate chip cookies for your own swearing in?
I did. I can multitask.
Did you make enough for everyone?
I made a lot. My old office, you know, we ran on food. The tradition in my office was that on your birthday, you brought in donuts for the whole office. And there were about 100 of us lawyers and staff. So that meant we had donuts just about every day. We were big on food and homemade food in the office.
Great. I'm not sure how to segue from that to seditious conspiracy.
I'm not sure there's any
that's challenging
way to segue
for me.
To seditious conspiracy.
I like to do a good segue. I don't see how I do that. So we're just going to talk about seditious conspiracy. As people may have read, at long last, one of the more serious statutes that can be charged in connection with the things that happened in and around January 6th was charged. Now, a bunch of these folks in an organization called the Oath Keepers had already been charged with various crimes. But now a new indictment charges, I think, is it 11, Joyce? 10 or 11? I think it's 11.
11.
11 people with seditious conspiracy, which is one of the things that people have been wondering. And I think you and I wondered how some of the conduct that has been observed and talked about was not charged. Shall we remind people what the seditious conspiracy statute says?
We should. And I'll say that I think a couple of days after January 6th, I wrote a piece for Time speculating, before we really knew what the evidence would look like, about what some of the possible charges were. And seditious conspiracy made the top of my list. It's 18 U.S.C. 2384 for anyone who wants to read along.
And do you think people pull up a statute and read along with us?
I have noticed, at least on Twitter, that if you link to a statute to make it easy for people to find, that they're grateful and that they'll go and read it. And sometimes the language and, you know, I mean, we all know how people in Congress write statutes. They can be a little bit obscure. So it's good to have somebody who's worked with the statute break it down for you, like we're about to do. But it's good to see the language for yourself, too, I think.
So here we go. I won't read the entire statute, but the relevant part essentially says, quote, if two or more persons conspire to overthrow, put down, or to destroy by force the government of the United States, or to levy war against them, or to oppose by force the authority thereof, or, and this I think is the important one for our purposes, or by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the United States, or by force to seize, take, or possess any property of the United States, contrary to the authority thereof, they shall each be fined under this title, or imprisoned not more than 20 years, or both, end quote. With many statutes, you have, you know, multiple options to pursue criminal charges under. The most relevant one here, Joyce, is which?
It's definitely by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of law. The way I think about this statute, this is my sort of inelegant characterization, is that it's an agreement to use force to screw with the government, right? The two essential things here that make this charge different from some of the others is the conspiracy component. There has to be an agreement. And then there's got to be some element of use of force. That's not a plain reading of the statute, by the way, because some of the items appear to be independent of the use of the word force to modify them. But case law makes clear that for something to rise to the level of sedition, force has to be involved.
Right. And we should also point out, and we'll discuss some historical examples, seditious conspiracy is not frequently charged. Part of the reason for that is the conduct that would constitute seditious conspiracy doesn't happen all that often, thankfully, in the United States of America. Also, there's a tough bar to prove all these elements. Also, there's a First Amendment aspect to this. So if people are talking about stuff, talking about a revolution, talking about radical moves, depending on what they do on top of talk, there's a First Amendment protection for that activity. And then finally, historically, particularly in recent history, there have been cases of seditious conspiracy brought that have failed. One famously that you and I have chatted about in recent weeks was one brought in the Eastern District of Michigan about 12 years ago, I think in 2010, that went very poorly for the government. Do you want to address that?
Yes. Yeah, so this is the Houtari case that was actually brought during the Obama administration by our friend Barb McQuaid. And the Houtaris were a group that had an ideology similar to sovereign citizens. They were government protesters, tax protesters. And the conspiracy that ends up getting charged in this case involved an alleged agreement among this group to kill a police officer and lure other police officers in at his funeral and essentially to go to war against the police, who they thought were their enemy, who they called the Brotherhood. So the government puts on its evidence, the government gets an indictment, government goes to trial, government puts on its evidence, and after the close of the government's evidence, the judge dismisses the case against most of the defendants and dismisses everything related to seditious conspiracy.
Right. And that also, by the way, is quite rare. The judge didn't even let it get to a jury. Now, part of the reason for that, as you might imagine, just because you do bad stuff and you plan to engage in violence doesn't mean the particular statute of seditious conspiracy has been violated. And what the judge wrote again and again in her opinion was essentially some version of the fact that a mere breaking of a law in the United States of America cannot constitute seditious conspiracy. So she says, the government presented evidence of vile and often hateful speech and may have even shown that certain defendants conspired to commit some crime. But she says that doesn't suffice. That's not enough. Offensive speech and a conspiracy to do something other than forcibly resist a positive show of authority by the federal government is not enough to sustain a charge of seditious conspiracy. Elsewhere, she says, a mere violation of law is not enough. There must be an attempt to prevent the actual exercise of authority. What did you think of that?
So I think this opinion is a cautionary tale for people who believe it would be easy for the government to extend this case to the president and those around him. I'm not saying that that's impossible, but I'm saying it's a heavy lift based on what we know now. And one of the most important things people need to appreciate is that the core of this charge, seditious conspiracy, is the agreement to enter into a conspiracy. And the judge in the Houtari case cautions that when these cases occur in the shadow of the First Amendment, that you have to really scrutinize the conduct and make sure that every defendant entered into the agreement that's being charged. And so, you know, what might that mean, for instance, if we were looking at, take your pick, people around Trump or Trump himself? There would have to be proof beyond a reasonable doubt that everyone who was charged in the conspiracy shared a unity of purpose, that they intentionally entered into this agreement to use force to prevent the certification of the vote. And so this notion that there has to be a stage at which you can prove entry into an agreement, and that agreement would have to be about the use of force to prevent the certification, those are some really serious proof elements that the government would encounter if it was looking this direction.
Further to that, the charge here with respect to the Oath Keepers is much more in line with the intent and language of the seditious conspiracy statute for a bunch of reasons. One of them is...
Oh, yeah, it's a poster child.
It is, right? So I think the Hatari case is quite different. Here, what's the location of the attack? What is the object of the attack? It's literally the seat of government. It's literally the place where laws are made and where laws are passed and laws are attempted to be executed, as was the case on January 6th.
You know, this case really has everything that the judge in the Hutari case claimed the government was lacking in that case, right? Direct evidence that all of these guys were interested in using force to achieve the outcome of their agreement. So when you add to that the location, it makes this a very strong case, and we would expect a strong case from this very cautious Justice Department.
And with respect to that clause that we keep emphasizing, to delay the execution of any law of the United States, it's not some amorphous, generalized opposition to the government or some assertion of sovereign citizenship or anything like that. There is a particular law that was being executed that everyone in the country knew about on January 6th to certify the votes of the Electoral College. And that is the thing that they tried to delay the execution of. It's stated. It was their clear intent. It's been confirmed by plea after plea after plea on the part of other folks. And the other thing that makes this kind of conspiracy a little bit easier to prove is there's really two categories of conspiracy cases. There's the category of conspiracy case where you foil a plot, right? Where you have people meeting and exchanging text messages and emails and maybe having discussions where they plan to do something, kill a person or rob a bank or whatever the case may be, and you foil it and you arrest everyone before it happened. And a lot of the defense will focus on the fact that, well, they didn't really accomplish it, not necessary under the law, but as a pragmatic matter to some jurors, depending on how far they went, defense lawyers will make the argument, well, they were just thinking about it. They were just sort of fantasizing about it. It didn't really happen. And then the other category is after the fact, you charge various crimes and a conspiracy, and the bank has already been robbed or the person has already been killed. And here, we're in the second category. You don't have to speculate about whether or not they intended to carry this through or not. They did. The Capitol was attacked. They did make plans to have weapons on reserve, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that flies?
I think it does. You know, this conspiracy was one Mike Pence away from completion of its objective. So it's not really a case where they can argue they didn't intend to carry through. What really interests me about this, Preet, is this notion that there could be more than one conspiracy here. And the separation mark, the mark of demarcation, would be people who wanted to use force and people who didn't. So you could have these folks who were boots on the ground, who were, you know, forming quick reaction forces and preparing to ferry firearms in from Manassas, Virginia, into the District of Columbia, clearly an intent to use force. And then perhaps there were others who viewed this at a more cerebral legal level. And that would be this 1512 charge we've seen, this interference with a government function, but in the absence of the use of forces, a somewhat less serious crime. And that's an important thing to remind people of, that this may not all be one big ball of wax, that it's possible that multiple groups wanted to interfere with the election and that they had their own little groups planning. Maybe they're conspiracies, maybe they're not, but that it's not needful that it all be the same large conspiracy.
Bottom line on the seditious conspiracy charge, strong charge, looks like it fits the statute. I think much more able to be proven than the Hatari case and some others that legal experts talk about. Not sure it will go any further with respect to seditious conspiracy against other folks, including the circle around the president. Strong move by the department. Yay or nay?
I agree. It is strong. And I'm a little bit bullish on the government's ability to go at least a little bit higher up. There's something that fascinates me, and I wonder if it caught your attention too. This is the lawyer, the head of the Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes, and his lawyer at one point on TV said that they were waiting for Trump to activate them. I don't think that that inculpates Trump. What interests me about that is, you know, was that just a casual statement, or were they having conversations with someone who led them to believe that might be the case? And if so, who were they talking to? That's the story that I would want to hear about next if I was investigating this case.
One other point we should make about why we are at the point we're at. So these folks had been charged before with other crimes. It appears that one or more folks flipped. And it further appears that one or more of those folks provided encrypted messages to the government so that the new indictment on seditious conspiracy has chapter and verse about the communications between and among these co-conspirators, which I don't believe the government otherwise would have gotten. And that's what brought it up a level, I think, to allow them to charge seditious conspiracy. So, you know, there is some of this going on that we talk about. You charge people, you put pressure on them, they provide information to you if they flip, and then you can charge not only people higher up, but you can charge even the people you've already indicted with something stronger and meatier, right?
And that's typical. We would often do that in conspiracy cases, you know, whether it was human trafficking or drugs or a bank robbery conspiracy. You would keep trying to work from the least culpable people up to the most culpable people, because you always, as a prosecutor, want to make sure that those who are most responsible are held accountable, if you can develop the evidence to do that.
Now, we get to this question that I've been asked a lot, and I know you've been asked a lot, and people speculate about a lot, and that is, you know, what other things and what other people are the Justice Department and the FBI targeting in connection with either the big lie, the efforts to overturn the results in Georgia and other states, and obviously the insurrection itself, and the evidence of a penetrating investigation that would also involve approaching some of these folks around Trump, Trump himself, family members, staff members, secretaries, the chief of staff, and others, the evidence that they're actually approaching those folks does not exist.
Yeah, it's notably absent. And I think every time one of us says this, we disturb a lot of people. But I mean, this is the reality that before Merrick Garland gave his speech on January 5th, where he promised a robust investigation, there was no indication of a hard look at Trump and his inner circle over any of these events. I think there was some reporting this week that the Georgia Secretary of State, who Trump made the infamous recorded phone call to asking for 11,780 votes so he could win the election, that he had not been contacted by anyone at the FBI or at DOJ. Whether that changes after Merrick Garland's speech is something that I'm looking at, because, you know, something that I think we're focusing on here is that this wasn't just one crime. This was a series of potential crimes that should be investigated in connection with the big lie.
To be clear, you're not saying, and I'm certainly not saying, that there are particular people, Trump and others, who should absolutely definitively be charged.
No.
Based on certain conduct. What we're saying is, you know, there are two phases to anything, and I separate these out in the book I wrote that I plug sometimes. At the investigative stage, the threshold for examining conduct is much lower, and has to be and should be and necessarily is much lower than it would be to bring a charge, to bring an indictment, when you're going to be put to your proof and have to undergo a public trial. Sometimes it's the case, and people forget this, that not only is the issuance of a grand jury subpoena or subpoenas appropriate to figure out if a crime has been committed, but also to satisfy yourself that a crime has not been committed. And so when there's, you know, the analogy always is that when there's smoke, you go where the smoke is. Often it's a fire, sometimes it's not a fire, but you bring all your gear and you investigate the smoke coming out of a residential building. And here, I think it's fair to say that the conduct of the former president and the people around him with respect to Georgia, with respect to perpetrating the big lie, with respect to his statements and lack of action on January 6th is smoke and should have been investigated. Now, there are various ways to investigate. You can get communications from third parties that probably wouldn't leak and we wouldn't know about that. But at some point, you have to go to the folks themselves, either the people who received phone calls and pressure, and also the people that might have organized such calls or asked for such calls to be made or made those calls, you talk to them also. What is the explanation that you can give as to why over 12 months later, it does not appear that those things happened?
You know, I don't really have a good one. And I'm just not certain. I suppose you could make the case for some of this stuff, that we want to avoid being the sort of banana republic that routinely charges the most recent leader of the country once he or she leaves office. And I like that principle, but that principle doesn't apply to the extraordinary times we live in, where we had a president who perpetuated a long-term narrative that was designed to keep him in office after losing an election. And Georgia's a really good example, Preet. I mean, you know, talk about a place where there was a lot of smoke. There is a big cloud that continues over Atlanta. And if somebody running for the Senate or you know, an office like that had done something similar, had engaged in this sort of a scam to try to get officials to find him more votes, there would undoubtedly be a federal investigation if there was jurisdiction. As you point out, whether there would be a prosecution is an entirely different question that turns on whether you've got sufficient admissible evidence, whether there's a First Amendment issue, all those sorts of considerations. But a full frontal investigation would be taking place. And that's what I struggle to explain, why we don't see signs of that here.
We should also maybe make more clear why it is that it's our conclusion that those interviews have not been sought, because there are a lot of folks who keep speculating that, well, they run a tight ship. They don't leak. They're very secretive. And all of that is true, especially with this group. But it is just the way the world works. When people get approached, particularly this sort of group of folks who, as I've said before, maybe unprettily, they squeal like stuck pigs when anybody tries to get information from them. You see that with the 1-6 Select Committee, I find it to just be an impossibility that some of these people around Donald Trump, if they had been approached by the FBI, wouldn't seek to avoid giving information and complain about it and try to stop it through court or otherwise. It's not possible to me that, you know, 20 people have been interviewed quietly and nobody has said anything about it, even if the government has not said anything about it, right?
I think that's right. And you know, like I do, the media is very sophisticated about grand jury investigations. And even when you take steps to secure the grand jury, they ultimately will see people going in and out of the courthouse and will talk to lawyers. And unlike prosecutors or courthouse personnel or members of the grand jury, witnesses are free to talk about being subpoenaed to the grand jury. So that's typically where information comes from.
Can I ask you a question off script?
Yeah.
That you're not prepared for, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because I got asked it yesterday. I did the show that Ben Wittes and some of his friends do every day at 5 p.m. called In Lieu of Fun, that he started during the pandemic. And he said, and I've been thinking about it since he asked me the question, so I'm going to ask you. You know, the statute of limitations is nearing expiration on some subset of the potential obstruction charges that were outlined in Volume 2 of that very ancient Mueller report.
Yes.
And at the time, a lot of people said that there's clear evidence that Donald Trump obstructed justice, maybe not conspiracy with Russia, but did obstruct justice. And at the time, he was the sitting president of the United States, and Mueller made clear that you can't indict a sitting president of the United States under prevailing Office of Legal Counsel policy and memos. And the question Ben asked me was not even necessarily, should Trump be indicted based on some of that conduct outlined in the Mueller report? But does the Justice Department, does Merrick Garland owe us some explanation in advance of the expiration of the statute of limitations about why Trump would not be indicted if he's not going to be? Or do you have any expectation that there will be an indictment based on that stuff from the Mueller report?
Two things. I think the answer to whether Merrick Garland owes the country an explanation is yes. And I think if Merrick Garland's goal, as is often stated, is to resurge the integrity of the institution, if his goal is to rebuild the Justice Department with credibility as an apolitical entity that operates strictly on the basis of the law and the facts, then he should explain why he is rejecting Bob Mueller's layout of potential charges. That's not the typical DOJ thing to do, by the way.
It's contrary. I mean, I'm a little bit surprised to hear you say that, because one could argue that's what got Jim Comey in trouble, right? Explaining why he didn't charge.
That's what I was going to say, right? I mean, this looks so much like a Comey thing. There is an election looming. And so I would think that rather than sort of doing what Comey did and talk about the facts, it would be a good thing for Garland to explain from a principled point of view why they weren't charging. Either they had reviewed the charges and there was insufficient evidence, or they had reviewed the charges and determined it wasn't in the national interest to charge. You know, that's sort of that Banana Republic piece.
But, you know, we don't even know, and it's not knowable, whether anyone at a significant level at the Justice Department under the new Attorney General has undertaken a serious review of the allegations in the Mueller report. And isn't it possible that nobody wanted to go there and it's just sitting in a desk drawer somewhere, unexamined?
So I think that's crazy if that's the case, right? I mean, I always tell my kids, you can't ignore stuff that's troubling. It doesn't get better if you just let it sit. I think this is one of those cases where they should have looked at those allegations, made a decision about whether they were prosecutable, made a decision about whether the right thing to do was prosecuting. And then because the country has lived through this crazy, bizarre, traumatic time, I think this is one of those exceptional times, sort of like what the department did after Ferguson, when it came out and announced that it wasn't prosecuting and why, and introduced the pattern and practice case. I think this is one of those times when radical transparency benefits the country. It's an opportunity to explain how and why DOJ works when it faces some of the most serious allegations it faces. If handled properly, instead of a Comey moment, we could have a Garland moment that built trust and transparency.
Do you think it's possible, and then we'll move on to something else, that Merrick Garland or others have made the internal determination that with respect to culpability and accountability on Donald Trump's part, that there was already an effort to do that. And it was done by the political branches. He's a political office holder. He's the head of the executive branch, the leadership of a separate but co-equal branch of government, the Congress, attempted to hold him accountable for precisely these kinds of things that we're talking about, incitement to insurrection on January 6th. And that failed. And that having failed sort of settles the matter. And for another part of the executive branch in a subsequent administration to go after some of that same conduct seems Banana Republic-y or seems inappropriate. I'm not saying that's true. I'm not saying I would agree with that. But I'm wondering, just insofar as we want some explanation as to why maybe some of this investigation doesn't look like it's happening, is that a possibility in your mind?
That's the best explanation I have for their absence to act. But let me just say this. I think it's clearly wrong, and I think Mitch McConnell told them that it was wrong at impeachment when he pointed out that Trump could face prosecution, that there was legal accountability in addition to political. And I know everyone listening will recall that famously, the impeachment managers did not have access to key witnesses and key testimony, even stuff that has emerged since then that would seem to have bearing on this and that would mean that the political process just wasn't a sufficient test of responsibility here.
So look, we'll see. It's just unclear what's going on. Should we talk about Kevin McCarthy?
We should.
Should we update folks on the continuing saga of Kevin McCarthy, the would-be next Speaker of the House, possibly? And the degree to which he will or will not cooperate with the 1-6 Select Committee?
Not particularly surprised on this one, but Kevin McCarthy, he who originally said that, of course, he would unquestionably cooperate with the January 6th investigation, has now refused to comply. He had a lot of reasons, by the way, that he would not be testifying. First off, he said the committee was conducting an investigation that wasn't legitimate, that was a political witch hunt. Then he complained that the committee was demanding testimony from staffers who had a First Amendment privilege. He complained that the committee was subpoenaing calls from private citizens and their financial records. And he also was offended that the committee had held people in contempt of Congress. But when it came to himself, he said, well, look, I've talked about everything that I'm going to talk about in the public, so you've already heard it. Of course, that wasn't under oath. And he said, private conversations that aren't remotely related to violence at the Capitol, I'm not going to discuss those. So apparently McCarthy is the rare witness who gets to decide what is and what isn't relevant to an investigation. He has a lot of reasons for not complying, and they all ring hollow, don't you think?
They do, with one exception, which I'll mention in a moment. But the other thing that's really interesting here with respect to Kevin McCarthy and some other people is what their immediate reaction was after 1-6. And it wasn't so defiant, and it wasn't so minimizing. And some of this stuff that Kevin McCarthy said has recently come to light. He did a podcast. There's sound that I think we didn't know about before, where he said, here's one example of what he said almost immediately after the insurrection, quote, "Let me be clear to you, and I have been very clear to the president, he bears responsibility for his words and actions. No ifs, ands, or buts. I asked him personally today if he holds responsibility for what happened. If he feels bad about what happened, he told me he does have some responsibility for what happened, but he needs to acknowledge that." And even more sort of interestingly, also in the days following January 6th, Kevin McCarthy explicitly talked about a way to hold Donald Trump accountable. He wasn't on board with impeachment and conviction at trial, but still was supporting explicitly a censure of the president, which is not a small thing. It's not the most important thing, but it's not a small thing by the minority leader of the House of the same party as the sitting president of the United States. I had the same thought that I saw being expressed by a congresswoman whose name I'm forgetting on TV the other day. And she said, there's this concept in the law that gets around hearsay. There are various exceptions to hearsay, right? And one of those concepts is the notion of excited utterance, that the court will recognize that at the moment something happens, that a gun goes off or a fire starts or there's an argument, that what you say in that moment as an excited utterance has indicia of truth and probity. And that can sometimes defeat the general rule against hearsay, even if something different is said later. And she was applying that general principle to these statements by Kevin McCarthy, that in the wake, in the excited wake of January 6th, he was talking about censure and responsibility and how terrible this stuff was, and other Republican members of Congress were as well. But when they saw sort of the circumstances shift and Trump be defiant as months went by, they changed their tune. But they should really be held to the words they uttered at the time. What do you think of that?
You know, I agree with that. And I think for McCarthy, there's almost a moment in time that you can pinpoint, because he goes to visit Trump at Mar-a-Lago on January 29th, right before the impeachment trial takes place. And suddenly his story turns almost on a dime. So I think if this were a criminal investigation, you might be looking at whether or not there had been some obstruction with a witness there. But certainly for the purpose that you identified, those excited utterances early on in the immediate moments after January 6th concludes in those early days, I think that those are important. And I think it's fair game to question him about them. But can I make a guess about where you think he might have a legitimate objection to testifying?
You may.
I bet you want to talk about the legitimacy of the committee and whether it can proceed in the absence of a ranking Republican member.
No.
Really?
I mean, I think that's an argument. No, where I was going was the speech or debate clause.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so you think that means that he can't be subpoenaed or—
I think there's an argument. I think it doesn't ultimately succeed. I think it's a matter.
Yeah.
Is it a first impression? I don't know if it's a first impression, but it doesn't come up that much. And it's not, unlike some arguments, it's not a bullshit argument. You and I think, try to separate the strength of arguments that are made by people we don't agree with, right? So when members of Trump's team have said in the past, in response to requests for information, that the former president has absolute immunity or has absolute right to assert executive privilege, even though there's a different sitting president, that's nonsense. But then there are other arguments that are not as strong as maybe I think the winning arguments, but they're not nonsense. And, you know, the Constitution itself says, give some protection to members of Congress, though they're, you know, understandably not harassed and punished and penalized for doing the daily work of lawmaking. And so the Constitution says, for any speech or debate in either house, members of Congress shall not be questioned in any other place. That doesn't mean that members of Congress can't be prosecuted. We've seen that happen. My office has done it, and other prosecutors' offices have done it. But things that happen on the floor are a little bit different. And some of the actions here are things that happened on the floor. There's another category of stuff that happened that was not necessarily related to Kevin McCarthy's duties as a member of Congress. But, you know, I think the speech and debate clause mucks it up a little bit, or do you think that's silly?
No, I actually think it's an important argument, and this is a really good opportunity, should this get into the courts, to decide what exactly the speech or debate clause means. I think you're right that ultimately this concern gets zeroed out We're lucky to have a constitutional law scholar in the form of Jamie Raskin from Maryland, who's in the mix on this debate. But there has been reporting that the committee itself is intently focused on this legal issue here and making sure that they get it right. I'm less concerned about getting past the speech and debate clause issue and actually issuing subpoenas than I am with the committee's ability to enforce them if these members of Congress continue to defy them, which I expect they will.
Well, the next interesting question is going to be, if they issue a subpoena to McCarthy and he defies it, going back to the Justice Department again, will they do what they did with Steve Bannon? The Steve Bannon case was much easier call than bringing a contempt of Congress case against a sitting member of Congress, and not just any sitting member of Congress, but the leader of the minority.
Yeah, I mean, DOJ is still sitting on the Mark Meadows referral, right? They haven't made a decision about whether to charge the White House chief of staff. This case is even more difficult. So where does that leave them? They've got two other options, right?
My guess is also, given how straight-laced these folks are in the Justice Department, which is good, and I think the members of the 1-6 committee, you might imagine in some circumstance in which there's sort of a back-channel conversation between the committee and DOJ, in which they say, hey guys, we're thinking of voting on contempt of Congress referrals for, among other people, Kevin McCarthy. How would you view that? And I'm betting $1,000 that a request for an advisory opinion on that would be met with noncompliance. I don't think they're going to offer that. You can't have an informal understanding between the committee and DOJ. So the committee is going to have to make a decision not really knowing what DOJ will do. Do you think that's right, or do you think there'll be some kind of communication?
I think that's right. I would be stunned if DOJ was willing to give them an advisory opinion on this.
And then the question is, if the committee issues a subpoena, votes on contempt of Congress referrals, and DOJ doesn't act, how does that make the committee look?
I have always believed that if they hit that point where they can't enforce a subpoena, then the whole gig is up, right? I mean, it really eviscerates Congress's ability to investigate. And that's an important power, because something that you have to understand is that Congress needs information in order to be able to craft smart legislation. And sometimes that means you need to be able to exercise your subpoena power. So it's a dangerous point to be at. There are two other options. One is this notion that Congress has an inherent ability to enforce its subpoenas through inherent contempt. Of course, you and I have discussed in the past that that hasn't been used for a very long time. It's an unwieldy mechanism at best, although there is some legislation pending brought by California Congressman Ted Lieu to sort of revitalize that as an option that hasn't gone anywhere. And so the other option, the more realistic option, would be to enforce the contempt through a civil case. I suspect one of the reasons the committee hasn't gone that route so far is because that involves potentially lengthy delays as cases make their way through the courts. Not that criminal is super speedy, but it's perhaps a little bit quicker. I think the example is that some of the contempts that were enforced civilly during the Trump administration, it was a couple of years, for instance, before former White House counsel Don McGahn ever testified. So that's also an imperfect mechanism. I mean, what's a January 6th committee to do here, Preet? It doesn't look like they have a good option.
Yeah, although I will say, I will sort of temper that with the reminder that we spend a lot of time naturally on the small number of people who have defied the subpoenas, Steve Bannon, Mark Meadows, Kevin McCarthy, and some others, but that scores and scores and scores of witnesses have come in, including former members of the Trump administration. They have, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of, and even with Mark Meadows, who was planning to cooperate before he changed his mind, they got thousands and thousands of pages of documents and text messages and communications. So they have a lot. Will they have everything because some people are defiant? No. But I don't want to give the misimpression that, you know, the report will be empty because they have a lot of information.
I think that's right here, but isn't the problem that if there's a precedent set that says Congress can't enforce its subpoenas, that in the future, for instance, a Mark Meadows would have no incentive whatsoever to cooperate early on? And this is something we're going to have to deal with going forward, we in the global sense, finding a way for Congress to make clear that it's not a toothless tiger when it comes to running these investigations.
Look, it depends on which category of person is beyond the reach of a subpoena. DOJ and the Congress have made clear that a private citizen like Steve Bannon is not beyond the reach. They, I think, will make clear that a mere staffer in the White House with respect to things that are not covered by privilege is not beyond the reach. Whether members of sitting members of Congress themselves are beyond the reach, I don't know how that will play out, but that's a narrower category. Speaking of members of Congress, see, that's a better segue.
That was a good one.
Than the chocolate chip cookie segue from before.
There was never going to be a good chocolate chip cookie.
Seditious conspiracy segue. To take Joyce Vance's chocolate chip cookies. You could probably charge that. Matt Gaetz is in the news again. He is that congressman about whom we have heard for some months now under investigation for underage sex trafficking. The details are not clear. The reason he's in the news again in the last week, there's reporting that his ex-girlfriend has come in and testified in the grand jury. And further, as of last night, we don't know the exact type of immunity that she got, but she apparently was offered some kind of immunity deal in exchange for her testimony. And the question is, Joyce Vance, should you decide to answer it, does this mean that Matt Gaetz, A, is likely to be indicted, and B, this is nearing the end of the investigation?
So I think this probably signals that they're close to the end. The answer to whether he gets indicted depends on what their evidence looks like. Do they have
enough?
That's
a dodge. You're just dodging now.
No, it's really not a dodge, though. It really is the answer, right?
Of course you can't answer that. We don't know.
It always depends. But can we say this? One other thing that we don't know. You said it wasn't clear what kind of immunity she had, and I think that's important here. Was this someone who wanted to cooperate but needed the assurance that she wouldn't be prosecuted and then proceeded to tell everything that she knew and perhaps more importantly provide any documentation or text messages or other stuff that she has? Or is this someone who didn't want to testify, who they forced to testify by giving her immunity and compelling the testimony? The distinction between those two different kinds of testimony can be the world here.
You know, one reason you can say, I don't want to come testify, is you don't want to incriminate yourself, and you plead the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. That risk to you can be taken away, can be removed against your will by being granted immunity, right? So if you're told that you're not going to be prosecuted for that conduct, you can talk about it, and you're not at risk of being prosecuted for it because the prosecutors have in advance agreed not to do that. That doesn't mean that this is a forthcoming, you know, friendly witness who's excited to come and spill the beans. It just means that they're being compelled to do so by a court because they no longer have a risk of prosecution. And that's a little bit different from the kind of witness who comes in and is excited to tell you stuff.
So I think stay tuned on this, but getting to a witness like the ex-girlfriend does suggest to me that they're almost to the end of the line on investigating. Preet, over the weekend, we all watched in horror as an individual took four hostages during morning Shabbat services at a synagogue in Colleyville, Texas. One of the names that surfaced in the course of that siege was a name that you had heard before.
Yeah, so, you know, I was sitting at home on Saturday, and I got a text or an email from a CNN producer who mentioned the ongoing hostage situation, and I didn't have the news on at the time, which is, I guess, rare for me, but I didn't know what they were talking about. And the text explained that there was somebody who was claiming to be the brother of Afia Siddiqui and was demanding her release from federal prison. And they said, you know, we're told that you may have some connection to the case. Well, indeed I do. This person who engaged in the hostage taking, who was later apparently shot by the FBI after the four hostages escaped, or I guess one was released and then three escaped in dramatic fashion, he turned out not to be the brother of Afia Siddiqui, but I guess, you know, she's his sister in spirit. She was one of the, you know, probably the most significant early trial that I oversaw when I became U.S. attorney, and it was in January of 2010. Afia Siddiqui was this woman who's very bizarre. She's about 5 feet tall, weighs like 90 pounds. She's brilliant. She went to MIT undergrad. She got a PhD from Brandeis University. She's a neuroscientist from Pakistan. After 9/11, became radicalized, was linked to one or more groups of people who were planning terrorist attacks. She was an object of extreme interest by the intelligence community and the FBI in the mid-2000s. And then in 2008, she was actually apprehended by Afghan forces and brought in for questioning. This is a year before I became the U.S. attorney. And she was taken to a building that was not very secure. Members of the 101st Airborne, United States military, learned of her apprehension, went to go question her also. So you have all these armed men, and you have Afia Siddiqui, this radicalized scientist who wanted to do harm to the United States, sitting on the second floor of a building. And by the way, the day before, when she was taken into custody, had in her personal possessions 2 pounds of sodium cyanide, plans for making bombs, and what looked like targets for mass casualty events, including Grand Central Station, Statue of Liberty. So this is a person who wanted to do great harm to people in the United States of America and against American interests generally. She was essentially, although not proven in a court of law yet, a terrorist. She seizes a gun as the questioning is about to begin, or actually maybe after it started, that had been left on the ground somewhat stupidly by one of the military guys, and begins shooting at everyone in the room. Miraculously, nobody was harmed, nobody was killed, nobody was even shot. She struggles with the interpreter, who's trying to take the M4, which is the weapon she's using, out of her hands. One of the other military guys in the room doesn't have a clean shot at her because there's a struggle going on between her and the interpreter, manages to fire one shot into her stomach, drops her. They render aid. She's brought to the United States of America for trial for attempting to kill U.S. officials, military personnel, etc. During the trial, by the way, this is important to a point that I think we should make. During the trial, she's very defiant. She does a thing that's very unusual for defendants, and I'm sure this is, in your experience, unusual. She's constantly engaging in outbursts during the trial, some of them anti-Semitic. And for a period of time, she actually has to watch her own trial from her cell with a live video feed. She's convicted, and because a lot of enhancements applied, including the terrorism enhancement and the hate crime enhancement, she was sentenced to 86 years in prison. I spent a lot of time over the weekend, because I was getting questions about it, you know, reliving the case, talking to some, I should mention the prosecutors in the case, because they did an amazing job in what was a very difficult case. Traveled to Afghanistan, I think more than once. David Rohde, Chris Levine, Jenna Dabbs, who were great former prosecutors and friends of mine.
Really an amazing job in this case.
It was a very tough case for a lot of reasons. She took the stand in the case. You know, she claimed all of it was a lie, that she never picked up a gun, she never shot, even though you had many, many witnesses obviously saying the opposite. And she's become, you know, somewhat of a cause celeb in Pakistan and other places where, you know, they kind of think of her as their, unfortunately, Joan of Arc. And there have been other attempts to try to get her out of prison and trades. But the one thing that I wanted to mention with respect to, you know, not just the waging of jihad against America, but also the inherent anti-Semitism that she had and that apparently this hostage taker had. And in the immediate aftermath of the hostage taking, there was a statement from the FBI. I'm sure you saw it, Joyce. They tried to disclaim that the hostage taker, that this didn't have anything to do with targeting the Jewish community, which is odd when you consider the person he was trying to get out of prison was an anti-Semite, raging anti-Semite, that he chose a synagogue in Texas on the Sabbath and took the rabbi and other members of the congregation hostage. It seemed like a bizarre statement. Do you have any reaction to any of that?
I think this is sort of a blind spot that the FBI has. It's not for bad reasons. I think the point that they were trying to make was that this involved foreign terrorism. What that sort of ignores is the context and the unusual predicament that American Jews find themselves at the crossroad of two different brands of terrorism. I mean, on the one hand, you know, there are modern day Nazis marching through Charlottesville with tiki torches, chanting, "Jews will not replace us." And by the same token, you have a defendant here who I read that during her trial, she had actually asked for DNA testing on jurors to make sure that they weren't Jewish. Certainly the ideology that's really critical to this sort of form of bastardized Islam that we see in the jihad movement is grounded in anti-Semitism. And so for the FBI to sort of ignore the obvious when you have hostages taken in the middle of worship in a synagogue, that seems like a really inappropriate misstep. I noticed something last night that, I'll be interested to see what the follow-up on this is. President Biden had initially taken a very different stance from the FBI talking about anti-Semitism. Yesterday, I saw that he had walked that back a little bit and seemed to be more allied with the FBI's statement that this was an act of terrorism that involved some form of anti-Semitism.
I don't think there is sufficient information to know about why he targeted that synagogue, why he insisted on the release of someone who's been in prison for over 10 years, why he was engaged, why he was using anti-Semitic and anti-Israeli comments. We just don't have enough facts.
It was sort of a weak, watered-down statement, and I wonder if we're about to learn more about this hostage taker here that will justify that. It still seems very blind.
It's just very strange, especially when the reasonable and understandable response around the country, in New York City at least, and I'm sure in other places as well, a stepped-up police presence at Jewish houses of worship in those cities.
You know, the FBI has primary investigative responsibility for hate crimes, and so I think it's important for them to recognize these things for what they are. That, you know, this follows on the misstep after the spa killings in Atlanta, where they were slow to recognize that one of the motivations was a hate motive towards Asians. And so I think the important thing here is for Muslim and Sikh and Jewish and Asian and other groups to continue to try to raise consciousness about the sorts of hate that their communities experience.
Yeah, look, I have not taken a survey of synagogues versus churches. What I do know is, you know, people may know my mother-in-law is Jewish, my wife is Jewish. And my mother-in-law goes to a synagogue that for years, not, you know, going back decades, but for years, because of this concern about anti-Semitism and about anti-Jewish violence, has had an armed guard at the synagogue.
As do we. We pay an annual assessment fee above and beyond our membership dues to fund some pretty hefty security that we have in place at our temple.
Yeah, and do you see the same at churches? Does it seem necessary at churches in your area?
No. In fact, you know, my kids went to an Episcopal day school for elementary school that had no security. The Jewish day school in Birmingham has heavy security.
It's a sad state of affairs, obviously. So we should also say, notwithstanding, I don't know who put out the statement, maybe it was someone in a press office, you know, we should not let that overwhelm the excellent work that the FBI and the hostage team and hostage negotiators did with bringing this to a peaceful resolution for the hostages. It was really great work.
These guys do immaculate work. We had a case in Alabama involving school kids and a bus where they got the kids out alive. Nothing but respect for these folks.
Well, we'll continue to watch all the news that's happening. I'm sure we'll be talking about 1-6 again next week. And in the meantime, don't pig out on too many chocolate chip cookies, Joyce.
You know, next time we're together, Preet, I'll bring some.
Okay. Well, hopefully that'll be soon, before too long. Don't forget to send us your questions to letters@cafe.com. And also, don't forget our referral program. Go to cafe.com/referral.
We look forward to having you join us and to answering your questions.
That's it for this week. Cafe Insider is presented by Cafe Studios and the Vox Media Podcast Network. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Joyce Vance. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The senior producers are Adam Waller and Matthew Billy. And the Cafe team is David Curlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Namita Shah. Our music is by Andrew Doss. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.